Off the Ball. GAA.
It all depends on fitness, and it's a lot with the club. You know, Brian Stack is like the master key. He can do a lot of jobs there. And if he's out, you know, there's a lot of fires to put out as well.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to Off the Ball Sunday's Nottingham On special. It's Eve Conway here with you for the Sunday paper review. There's loads to get through, and I am delighted to be joined in studio by Orla McElroy, sports editor with the Irish Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday. Orla, how are you this morning?
I'm good, thanks. Good to be here.
Perfect. And beside her in studio as well, we have Cliona Foley, freelance sports writer. And how are you today?
Great, thanks, Eve. Good, hanging in there.
Hanging in there. So is it still acceptable to say Happy New Year on the 11th of January? I'll wish you both a Happy New Year anyway.
Many happy returns.
Yeah. This might be the last
we'll
weekend
take
we've
it.
Got.
I think this is the last one. Yeah. I won't get away with it after this.
And I'll wish you a Happy Nullignam On, even though technically it's, I think, the 6th of January is the official date. But I guess here in Off the Ball Towers, we're celebrating it today.
That's quite all right, isn't it?
It's
always good.
Yeah, it's a great day to do it. Yeah.
So before we dive into the biggest stories today, I'm just going to run through the back pages quickly and begin with the Sunday Independent. And the Emperors Have No Clothes is the one that I'm seeing here in front of me, talking about Ruben Amorim and Manchester United. It's sort of odd to remember that he was only sacked on Monday. It feels a very long time ago now. But we'll move on to that later on. The Irish Sunday Mirror have crystal balls up. Cup holders didn't see this coming as non-leaguers pull off biggest shock since 1909. And that is Macclesfield FC beating FA Cup holders Crystal Palace in the third round yesterday. Plenty to talk about there. Then the Irish Mail on Sunday, moving away from the football and going into the rugby, a Harry ending as Burns' dramatic last-gasp penalty clinches victory for Leinster over arch-rivals Ronan O'Gara's La Rochelle last night in the Aviva Stadium. And the Sunday Times running with that as well, Burns' night as last-gasp penalty gives them a nail-biting win. The Irish Sunday People are going back to the football with Supermac, which I like. The Silkmen produce shock of the century as they dump Holders Palace. And then again, above that, census. Schmeichel lays into United over Ruben Axe. I think all the papers carrying various ex-Manchester United players and their woes today. The Irish Sun on Sunday going Mac and Flies. Owner Rob vows to pay for I beat the holiday after heroic Silkmen kick out Holders 117 places above them. And then finally, the Sunday World, who go with Ole's back at the United wheel. Solskjaer set for a sensational return to Old Trafford dugout until end of season. Rumours flying around about that. So I suppose you may start with the football. And I guess the biggest story of yesterday also is probably the biggest FA Cup story in pretty much its entire existence, with the Holders being knocked out by Macclesfield FC, 117 places below them. People speak about the magic of the FA Cup a lot, and I suppose here's a prime example of it.
Yeah, for sure. Like, it's an amazing story, and there was like plenty in the papers this weekend on Saturday as well about the owner Rob Smethurst and how he'd bought them. He's a guy who had, his own story is
his
amazing before you even get
ridiculous.
To Macclesfield.
Absolutely, like, yeah.
He'd sold a business, a car trading app or something.
Yeah, and one of those car sales.
Yeah, made huge money, and then sort of had not a lot to do with himself, found himself struggling with alcohol. Off the back of a 4-day bender, went and bought the club because it was in receivership and closed down. And there's a documentary apparently, and he's walking around the grounds with, you know, bits of grass coming out of the tarmac and broken seats. And he's trying to, you know, open doors with this big bunch of keys he's got. He bought it on Rightmove, just bought it off the website. Yeah. I woke up the next morning going, I think
what
I bought
them. Yeah. When you wake up the next morning, you're wondering, what did I do last night? That's something to remember.
It's not one I've ever experienced, but yeah, it's an interesting one. But he said, like, I read a story about him yesterday, and he was talking about how, he had to tell the wife.
Yeah.
The next day,
I bought a football club.
Yeah. I mean, how do you explain that one? Like,
I know somebody who bought a very posh motorbike once and hid it in a in a thing for putting horses in, you know, for about 6 months before he told his wife. But imagine telling you about a football club.
Yeah, yeah, there's no hiding that one. You can't hide that one away. Like he said, he was still in the doghouse over the 4 day bender when he asked his wife to meet him at the football club. I told her to just Google it and she'd find me. I was already in the bad books and she asked me what we were doing there. I said, I've bought the place. That was the final straw. We split up for a good 6 or 7 months.
Oh my God.
He did manage to patch up his marriage and he's been sober for 5 years and the club is going from strength to strength, as evidenced by, you know, what went on yesterday. But it's just a wild story.
I'm sure and he's probably the only sober one out of that whole team now celebrating last night.
For sure, yeah. And he's promised, as you said, to bring them to Ibiza on holiday to celebrate the achievement.
I want to be on that party bus.
Oh, can you imagine? Yeah, the crack. And the club are managed by Wayne Rooney's little brother.
That's the other thing.
Were you watching
amazing,
it? Apparently he was
amazing.
In tears.
Rooney was in tears at the end of it. It's an incredible story. And actually, one of the papers today, I think it might be the Sunday Times have it. They have a gorgeous picture of them when they were kids, which is a really, really nice shot. And he was genuinely emotional about it yesterday. And he only took over the job basically because they couldn't get anybody else to do it. Like he's played a lot of football himself as well. It just, this is the story. I mean, if the Disney boys are over, you know, making movies in English football, they're just going to love Macclesfield.
Because, I mean, they're a team that they, you know, it's a phoenix club, really, of Macclesfield Town FC. He'd existed since 1874 until 2020 when they, you know, got into financial struggles. And then this miraculous story of a 4 day bender rescuing the club. So
when it's, it's a Sunday Times Eve that has that lovely photo, actually.
Oh, brilliant.
It's John, when he was 7 and Graham the 10 and Wayne is 12. It's a really cute photo as well. And it's just about how they compared and what they've done with football in their lives as well, because John had a really good career as well. But the interesting thing about them as well, and it's a theory, it's a theme that pops up in a few stories as well, is that the club has had terrible tragedy this year as well.
Oh, yeah.
So they had a player who was killed in a car crash, who John had brought into the club as well. And his parents were there yesterday. And this very often happens, I think, when you get these kind of stories that with an underdog team where there's some awful tragedy that has motivated them, and I think that's probably been a factor with this team, definitely.
Yeah, there's definitely that emotional bond. Like John Rooney talks about, he's quoted in a lot of places in you know, post-match he was talking about it. And he said, so as you said, he's a player he brought in, but
Ethan McLeod,
yeah. And his parents, Gillian and Gordon, were at the match to watch it, and they were in the manager's office afterwards. And John Rooney talked about how it's the hardest thing I'll ever have to do as a manager, and how I did it, I don't know. It ripped through the club, me, the staff and the players. Ethan was a special lad and a special talent. We spoke about him being here with us, and I didn't want to say too much to the lads because I didn't want to put any extra pressure on. It was only just the week before Christmas he opted to drive home from a game rather than taking the team bus. And it's
it was a terribly tragic twist to it, yeah.
And could have been devastating for the whole club.
Yeah, and I think you could see that in the way they played yesterday. They were playing for this guy, you know. Yeah. And that so often happens. All I could think of was the captain with the bandaged head after a cut, split in the head. He was like Willie Joe Patton, wasn't he? With the thing. And like, it was everything about it was just like, it was like Disney wrote the script, really. I mean, okay, Palace are where they are at the moment, and okay, they were the reigning champions. I mean, the FA Cup is not what it used to be, that has to be said. And beating the holders of the FA Cup in some respect is not the same as it would have been many years ago. But this is probably, you know, it is a story for the ages, really. And as I said, I can see it. I can see somebody making a Netflix will be onto this one, definitely.
Yeah. There's going to be another one of those. It's Portsmouth, isn't it?
Yeah.
Michael Eisner has bought the ex-Disney CEO has bought Portsmouth.
Yeah.
You've Wrexham doing
Wrexham
it.
The interest is there, and they love the romance of the stories. And now that you've got the Rooney factor as well.
Yeah.
It's just, it is made for it, yeah.
Yeah, you can kind of tell when you saw how emotional Wayne Rooney was getting after, you know, speaking to his brother about all of that, the family feel that these smaller clubs have. I mean, the pitch invasion at the end, the owner was getting involved and everything.
Oh, it's fantastic. Just watching it, even like the pitch invasion, you were thinking of GA. You know what I mean? It had that feel about it, didn't it?
Yeah, there's
and
a
I
lovely.
The piece that actually Simon Mullock has a good piece in the Sunday Times, and he's saying, there's one of the players, he's a DJ. He's a DJ in his spare time. So like if they do go on that trip to Ibiza, they're even bringing their own DJ. But like it's just sometimes I think one of them was a school, the guy who scored the goal was a school, first goal thing was a school teacher. Like, they're a real mix of everything, you know. It is like your classic old school FA Cup story.
Totally. And it is, and you know, because it's such a small club, you can imagine like everybody's mucking in together. You can imagine the, you know, the manager would be there helping, you know, get things sorted in the morning. And there's lovely pictures in the mail spread.
There's great photos there.
The captain, or the defender, Sam Heathcote, just grabbed a pint off somebody and downed it after the match, and the pitch invasion, which as you say is like a proper GAA,
yeah,
old school
like
pitch invasion.
Deal.
But there's a great line in this that so Wayne Rooney on the coverage, who was saying, you know, about how he was getting emotional and to see his brother achieving this, he had flown back from Barbados on Friday night, breaking up his family holiday to come and see the game.
So the kind of freezing cold temperatures you could see on the pitch, even, it was a bitter day.
Yeah, it was.
And
yeah,
you know, you get the sense that this is an environment that the Macclesfield players, you know, it's their home turf, they know how it's going to go. And Palace, when you think of their FA Cup victory last year, that was sort of seen as the magic of the club. They're beating City, this huge financial juggernaut of a club, and here's little Crystal Palace winning their first major trophy. But when you zoom out in context, Crystal Palace, a Premier League, I assume you can say stalwart at this stage, and Macclesfield in the National League North. It's the first time ever the team in the sixth tier of English football has beaten someone from the top flight.
And they've been, and they've promoted like from the Northwest Counties Premier Division. All the way to the National League North.
I know everyone always says, oh, the FA Cup's not what it used to be. I love these stories. I'm a sucker for them. I'm sorry. I'm totally romantic.
I am
a sucker for these kinds of stories. Yeah. And I think that they attract a lot of people who, and we'll talk about it later, are so sick and tired of the billionaires and the management systems that are now in football and all the data. It just puts the emotion and puts the real people back into football. That's why I still love the FA Cup for this possibility. Like, and it happened yesterday.
There was great clips of did you see the clips of the players in the dressing room afterwards, and they were all in the jumping around singing?
Well, they've sung that Adele song after every time they've got promotion. They sing this Adele song.
It was hard enough to identify their singing.
Exactly. I couldn't figure out what it was, and then I looked it up and something said it was one of the Adele songs. Yeah.
But I mean, a more enjoyable result than, you know, looking at City beating Exeter 10-1.
There's a great footage, a crowd footage from some Exeter fans when they scored that one goal. They're just going mental. They're having a great time. I suppose, listen, for every Macclesfield, there's also an Exeter where you have a giant of English football. No Erling Haaland on the score sheet, though. And Semenyo getting his first City goal.
Yeah.
So I suppose this is looking good for a team who are hoping to bring this form into the Premier League now and capitalise off of, you know, Arsenal dropping points. I think you can view it as dropping points against Liverpool the other week. So
that's actually touched upon in, I think it's in the Sunday Times, where they talk about that.
Alison Rudd's piece. She's a good piece on Arsenal. I like her attitude too.
Yeah, she's kind of saying like,
chill out, lads.
Yeah. Vatican, you know.
Yeah,
Arteta's kind of going, we're going to go again. And she's like, well, you only dropped 2 points against the champions. It's not the end of the world.
It's an interesting debate, and it'll continue about how Arsenal are finding it difficult to live up to the expectations now that the spotlight's on them. But her point is a really valid one. I think, what's the headline on it, Orla?
Arsenal need to chill out. A run of games away from home will do them good.
Yeah.
And one of the pull quotes that they pull out, which is just, this sums it up for me. The only threat to Arsenal winning their first league title since 2004 is, yet again, Arsenal.
and her last part is, life is good for Arsenal. Extremely good. If only they could start to believe it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is interesting to watch. Like, it was interesting to watch them in that game, almost go back into themselves. You always, I think as an outsider, you think, how does that happen to professional footballers? This is their life. Their mentality should be strong. Why do they doubt themselves in this way? And it's funny how it seems to almost, okay, obviously Liverpool, you know, upped the game and all the rest and changed things. But you do wonder, how do professional players not have that confidence to drive on? And it should be coming from management. And obviously he's trying his best.
Yeah. But it does seem quite fragile, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you look at, you know, how they are kind of, you know, you feel like they're not much going wrong away from a little bit of an implosion. And you wonder if City do start to find form, is that going to put enough pressure on that they'll, you know, suddenly just capitulate? You know, like Liverpool's loss of form during the early part of the season and how they were playing. And I mean, they still haven't really righted the ship, but there's, you know, there's a big confidence question there as well.
Yeah, yeah, it is interesting that they're not infallible to it. And I always think we expect them to be infallible, and I think the amount of money that they get paid and everything else that surrounds it now means we all. But they're still terribly human infallible.
You want a few GA managers in there, explain to them about the hunger and what it is they need to get in their heads for these matches.
Well, there was a great line in a piece yesterday about the new Cork senior hurling manager, O'Connor. And there was I'll get the name of the journalist who wrote it in a second. He said, there's a recurring tendency when replacing managers in all sports to go for a successor that is markedly different from the man before him. That's why you will have read in recent days of Manchester United's determination to find a manager that fits within their elaborately malfunctioning managing system. The next guy, the briefings vow, will toe the line the way Ruben Amorim wouldn't.
Yeah, Shane McGrath kind of touched on that today as well, didn't he, in your paper, Orla?
That's the one, isn't it,
as well? This thing of, he's a great line, really. He's saying nostalgia is proving United's toughest opponent. And nostalgia, I hadn't even looked at the piece that was below it. And in my own head, I was thinking about rugby from last night and today. And I was thinking, Munster have a terrible problem with this. And then I looked down and it says, Munster's still hampered by systematic issues. And he said, another institution governed too much by the past is Munster Rugby. In fact, there are a few better Indigenous examples. But this notion that, you know, one, that your future is based on how successful you were in the past, and two, that it's based on the manager who brought you that success in the past, it just seems to me to be such a laughable notion in some ways in modern sport, given everything else that's involved now. Mm. And this whole managerial shakeup that we've seen, and all of them rows about money, and the papers are full of it today. I mean, it's in every paper from every possible angle, and we'll talk about them in a minute.
It was Shane McGrath who
Great line, because he talks about the debilitating effects of nostalgia. It's a life source for a team's support in all sports, the glories of yesterday, you know. But he said that it has the potential as well to stymie everything, and this notion then that you have to, the next person up has to be radically different from the previous one, you know. And obviously Ferguson, it's all been talked about during this week about how Ferguson still stalks.
Hanging around like a bad smell.
United, yeah. Well, and your man's notion said, well, I had to check with Ferguson if I should take the job.
Oh, that was ludicrous.
I mean, that is ludicrous, Fletcher. Yeah, so that's like, but that kind of really, but the shows that Ferguson is still hanging around like a bad smell as well. But it also, it does bring into question, I think, this whole thing that how do you go forward and stop looking back, and where do you go from here for them?
And that's, I think, Shane McGrath points it out. It's been a problem with United. It's not a new modern day problem. No. I mean, yeah. You look at the early years of Sir Alex Ferguson. It says United at their best under Alex Ferguson still venerated the memories of the Busby Babes.
Yeah.
So it's almost like every era is still hearkening back to another one. But at least Sir Alex Ferguson was given the time and the resources to build something at United after a shaky start. Whereas you look in the, was it 12 years now or 13 years since Sir Alex Ferguson departed Old Trafford, they have had 10 managers in that time, a few cups, a Europa League. But I mean, what we're seeing now is ex-Man United players voicing all sorts of opinions.
In my opinion, they have an unduly huge influence on the conversation about professional football and about Man United, because so many of them are former players.
Yeah.
It is a very unusual relationship that's there. But like Shane points it out in this, he was saying like they're looking to go back to Solskjaer, and he says Solskjaer refused to park in the spot designated for the manager of the training ground, telling staff it felt like Ferguson's. So if you're bringing him back in and that's his state of mind, where are you going? They do need somebody who comes to this with a fresh view and a fresh eye. Then you also have the complications of players. Who are players going to respect? Who are players' agents going to respect? I mean, this is not what Ferguson had. Ferguson didn't have to deal with an awful lot of this.
No, it's a completely
layers
different
layers of management,
world.
Like, and
it's
layers.
Yeah, that, you know, and
different universe.
Completely. There's a lot of coverage of that across the papers where it talks about how, you know, that world is absolutely different. And, you know, as you said, Ferguson was given a lot more time. There's no way a manager would get that now.
It just
wouldn't happen. Liverpool did this as well with the boot room days, and they venerated that past, and, you know, they were beholden to it for long enough. Like, United were so beholden to Ferguson that they and Roy Keane is 100% right about that issue with Rock of Gibraltar was the, you know, the horse that broke that club's back. And it was Ferguson as well who recommended Moyes. It, you know, he's had a huge amount of influence, and you can't say that since his departure, it's been for the good.
No, and speaking of Roy Keane, there was Mark Gallagher in the Mail on Sunday speaking today about, you know, is Roy Keane the man, or is that a bit of a mad suggestion to even bring Roy Keane's name into the conversation for
I think that's, Mark was certainly suggesting that, like, you know, the idea originally came from Jamie O'Hara.
Yes.
And as Mark says, he is more from a former celebrity reality TV contestant into a bespectacled pundit. But as the week wore on, more serious and reasoned voices such as Danny Murphy were suggesting the only way to make Manchester United a proper football club again is to get Keane to whip the dressing room into some shape. You can imagine him going in there to whip them into shape. But he talks about, you know, O'Hara and how he says he was on an early morning show where a number of highly strung United fans sent in their own take on the latest crisis at Old Trafford via voice notes. So there's no reason to take what he said seriously. Murphy, on the other hand, who had plenty of battles with Keane in the centre of the park, is a whole different story. He should know better.
We'd kind of agree.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and he lays out the reasons why it's just not a great idea. And Keane himself seems
has clearly not interested. Yeah. And also, and again, we see it in several pieces today, including a very interesting piece in the Sunday Business Post. Keane is also making such a good coin now. Why would you want to go back into management?
Absolutely.
You know,
you imagine
you're making
a lot
coin.
Less pressure.
You're making coin for people who love you, who tell you how brilliant you are constantly every 2 seconds on Twitter or whatever they're calling it now. Why would you want to go back into a pressurized situation? And you know, the sale of that podcast now, it's been bought over by one of this big European. Neville's company has been bought over by one of these big European radio stations. So they figure now that it's going to get even bigger. And Keane is right in the middle of all of that.
And
there's absolutely no reason for him, financial, I think, emotionally or anything else, to go back into management.
I think Keane actually had one of the more reasoned views on what should be next for Man United. He's suggesting Eddie Howe.
And he has been mentioned a few times.
Now, whether Eddie Howe would be desire at all to leave Newcastle, there still is this, and I don't understand it, this view that Manchester United is a job you can never turn down. And I think that was Ruben Amorim initially wasn't interested in the job, and then they said, well, this is the only time we're going to offer it to you, and he left mid-season to join this team. As somebody who was very young myself when United were winning league titles and Champions Leagues, even then I still have this idea of Man United as this kind of very imposing figure in English football. But if you take purely the last 10 years, are they still a team that a manager like Eddie Howe would be bending over backwards to want to go to?
Well, that's the question. And would it be, like, it is a bit of a heritage thing now that, you know, they're the biggest club and it's still the biggest job. And you hear people saying, well, it is still the biggest job. Of course it's the job you're going to. But I just don't know. I mean, there's a great piece in the Sunday Times where Jonathan Northcroft goes through the death of the manager. And it talks about exactly this. What is a manager's role now? And we had that thing where Amorim came out and said, I came here to be the manager, not the head coach. And sorry, buddy, but
that was your title.
You were recruited as a head coach, and that is the role that you play now. You are not a manager in the way that we understood managers to be back in the days of Alex Ferguson and, you know, Jose Mourinho running Chelsea. Those guys were all powerful and were across everything and on top of everything. They organised the recruitment of players. They picked the players they wanted to buy. That doesn't happen anymore. So would you go from, you know, and there's been discussion about, like, Unai Emery is another name who's come up.
Yeah.
Where people are talking about him going, well, this is, you know, it's the opportunity to go to Manchester United. But when you consider your working conditions and what you're dealing with, are you not better off staying at Aston Villa? And he believes he can do a better job there.
They're third in the table. I think people are leaving them out of a conversation. They're level on points with Man City.
And again, that goes back to the heritage idea of, you know, if you get a reputation for getting up early in the morning, you can stay in bed all day. People have this notion of Aston Villa as a small club, and they have a notion of Manchester United as a big club.
Yeah.
But, like, look at Manchester United and Spurs last season. And
I think traditionally ego does come into it. I think if you're in the world of that.
That has to be the reason.
If you're in that world, I think if you know, and you're offered a job like Man U, your ego does go, wow,
well,
you know,
I could
heritage, legacy. I could be the one to turn it around. There's definitely that in it. And like it has been pointed out as well, like it's not like they're bottom of the table. They're just not where they used to be at the moment. We were having this discussion outside. Like, there's a great piece. This Jonathan Norcroft is a really good piece. I haven't seen the video, but he says that the 1958, this fans group have done this brilliant Queen at Live Aid thing, where they've got the three lads that is singing a Queen song. Is this a real club or just fantasy? So I have to go away and see that. It's definitely worth having a look at. But it's all about... His piece is really interesting, and it's all about, and we were talking about outside earlier, this thing of the notion of where do you fit a manager and a coach in with director of football, which has now become the prime position to have. And then on top of that, you've got the layer upon layer of owners, absent landlords, accountants, data people, you know, social media people, whatever else it is you want to be. So that's a piece well worth reading, I think, because it kind of crosses all of the different ones that's happened during the last few weeks with Chelsea and Celtic
it
and all the rest.
A huge amount.
And then the other piece today then is Eamon Sweeney's piece, and also in the Sunday Indo. And then also Rory Smith has a great piece as well in the Sunday Indo. It's an Observer piece, and it's a brilliant piece as well. And that's one. He's pointing out Chelsea were fifth and United were sixth when both of those managers were dismissed. So I was saying, like, he said, they didn't lose their jobs because of their failure. They were roughly where they were expected to be this season. Why they lost their jobs because their failure to understand the parameters of their role. And this is the big
and
question.
And how to work with their directors of football.
Yeah. And you know, the delineation between all of these jobs. The Emperors of New Clothes is the headline name is Sweeney PC, as you referred to it. And it's a great one. And he's just, I mean, the phrase chief clown and circus, that's the whole Man United team that keeps running this weekend. But it is everywhere, this notion that, as Eamon Sweeney says it, and it really drives me crazy, this notion that the ability to make lots of money in one sphere is an infinitely transferable skill underpins both the arrogance of the likes of Radcliffe at Man United and Dermot Desmond at Celtic and the deference with which they're treated. A golden age of rich guy hubris is reflected in the way that oligarchs run their football clubs. Chelsea have burned through 16 bosses in 19 years. Spurs have had 9 in 13 years and United 8 in 12. The data suggests that the managers may not be the problem. And I was saying to you think all the time about money and governance. In Ireland, we always, the governance in sports is a very serious topic and take it very seriously. But actually, I was thinking this morning driving in that somebody needs to design a course, you know, one of these great management courses that they do, but it actually needs to be about football because they're all applying business models to football. But actually, the model can't apply anymore because the players are too powerful or the managers aren't good enough, but actually because the people who own the clubs don't apply their own rules to the clubs because they don't give you enough time to achieve the job. So you don't get what you would get as a CEO of a major company. You don't get 1 or 2 years to turn a company around. You get, in some cases, you know, a couple of months.
And then how much interference do you have from above? Like, you've also got, you know, take United, for example. You've got, like, Jason Wilcox apparently telling Ruben Amorim how to pick the team. You've got Omar Berada. You've got Ratcliffe apparently weighing in on, I think you should, you know, consider playing him at left back. Like
Brian Nwemo, your star kind of forward who you bought during the most recent transfer window.
Why employ, what is it? Why have a dog and bark yourself? You pick, if he's not going to manage and he's not going to have the players to recruit and he's not going to have any say on any of that kind of stuff, he's going to put a team on the pitch. Let him put the team on the pitch and don't be telling them that you should put Nwemo in as...
But it is interesting that the reconstruction of football, if you like, and the money that's gone into football has come from business models.
Completely.
But actually those models don't fit because the premise that you give somebody a year or two in business, you know, you pay them big bucks.
It doesn't happen.
You give them the time to produce it. And if they don't produce it, then after several performance reviews, you get rid of them. That isn't even happening in football now. It's out of control.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't have any time to prove yourself.
And across a lot of those pieces, they talk about how, like, those guys who make the decisions, they don't get the performance reviews.
No,
they're
not answerable at all. Exactly.
Eamon Sweeney says, Wilfred Nancy.
Because I never liked the book Moneyball. And he says the idea of applied statistics as a sporting panacea was popularized by the book Moneyball. And if it has not been discredited, he says, it's certainly been questioned now, that notion of you can buy success if you have the right data and the right systems, but it takes so much else out of it. And your relationship with your players, all of that stuff, surely that has to be as important.
Exactly. Okay, we have to take a quick break here, but stay tuned as we'll be back with more of the Sunday Paper Review after the news. All right, you're welcome back to the Sunday Paper Review here on Off the Ball Sunday, where I'm joined by sports writer Cliona Foley and sports editor of the Irish Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, Orla McElroy. So we're going to turn our attention to rugby now. A big night of the Aviva last night with Leinster and a last-gasp Harry Byrne penalty, seeing them overcome La Rochelle. What a game.
It was great, wasn't it? And it's some great, I love Harry Byrne's name. It just gives some great headlines. All the back page headlines, the Byrne supremacy and, you know, Byrne's night.
I don't know about you, but it restored my faith in professional rugby, honestly, because I've watched so many balloon ball, as I call it, kicking games this winter.
Oh.
Just games of hunt and grunt and, you know, just stick it up the jersey stuff.
Yeah.
But actually last night we got a game and we got what a game we got and a game that just moved. It swung so dramatically. And then literally Leinster came up and stole it. And the image of Sam Prendergast's face when Harry Byrne took the ball off him and said, I'm going to kick this. And Prendergast had missed several conversions and wasn't kicking well. And then nailed it. It was just a brilliant piece of sporting theatre. And I'm interested, Shane McGrath, I thought, was very hard in your paper today on Leinster, saying so many questions remain about Leinster after this. But I thought the way they wouldn't quit, I think, and the way they defended at times, I thought was really admirable. And actually, no matter how okay, they didn't score for ages. They got two early tries by Joshua, as he's now called, and thank you to Bernard Jackman for explaining in the end that when he played for Pres Bray, he was Joshua, but he's now, or he was JJ.
JJ Kenny.
So JJ Kenny got his first two tries in the competition, but then they went scoreless for ages. But their ability to grind it out, you would have to say, was very admirable. And their defensive sets at times were just sensational.
Yeah, in fairness, it was great to see them doing it. Like, just what you're talking about being a good game, Rory O'Connor starts off by saying, this competition doesn't deserve these two.
And it's something
that, you know, you've seen in the Champions Cup. Like, they've made a mess of the competition.
Geez,
you know, like, there's people talking about how the competition doesn't even start till after Christmas. Like, it's only when you get to the later rounds of this unfathomable pool stage system that they have. It was a brilliant competition. They could make it that way again, but you need more games between teams like this, not teams that are, you know, finishing ninth in the pro, whatever it's called now. But yeah, so like the fact that Leinster came back is definitely very admirable. Like that grit and that willingness to keep fighting. Now, La Rochelle did have a lot of things that they'll be looking back and not very happy with.
Oh,
you'd have to imagine.
They locked it up one more times than they could remember. Like, they threw away tries. Literally.
Yeah, there was tries that should have gone in, you know, and they should have been further ahead. And how it was only, what was it, 12-7 at half time? I don't know. But like one thing that I think it's Bernard Jackman actually highlights is about the enduring fitness of the Leinster players, and to see Josh van der Fleer,
oh my god,
galloping down that touchline and, you know,
straight
going half
line,
the pitch,
like a winger,
and ducks inside and, you know, scores a try at the end of it. And La Rochelle were clearly feeling it at that point.
Like they were totally gassed.
Oh,
you could see
it.
They were blowing badly. Yeah, I have to say Henshaw. I think he's one of the most underrated players in Irish rugby.
Josh van der Fleer for me is that guy.
I thought Henshaw was sensational last night defensively. Every single time his head came up out of a ruck, you thought, how did he get where he got to? So, like, that's where I'd be first as well. I just felt, okay, they're not playing brilliantly. You know, they're dropping balls, they're making mistakes. The first 10 minutes, Leinster looked great. They had that old fluency. They were offloads were lovely. Then they went out of it. Then, oh my God, La Rochelle came back like lions in the second half. And you thought, no, this game is up. And they just wouldn't quit. And I think that's what I would take from that last night as well, was that they wouldn't quit. The only other thing I was saying to Eve outside is Frawley. I'd be worried about Frawley's injury, because he is going to be, I think, such an important player for Ireland if he keeps being as versatile as he's being.
Yeah. But it's good to see. I mean, Harry Byrne, you know, played as well as he did. And then the two wingers, like, you know, Kenny... The way he took those two tries was brilliant.
Oh, fantastic to watch.
Wasn't it? It was just so athletic.
And he was good defensively as well, too, when he needed to be later on. It's an interesting one. The Ireland 10 debate is going to continue as well. And the games today obviously will decide that as well.
Yeah, Munster again, Toulon, they're playing in France. But now, Jack Crowley, it's a big game now.
It is.
You know, you look at for so long, it's all been this kind of, it's a two horse race. It's very much not anymore.
No. And you've got, you know, is it this week that Andy Farrell is going to name squads?
That's going to, I'm not sure if it's this week or next week, but that's definitely a talking point, and it crops up today. And actually, there's a good piece, I think, is it Peter O'Reilly talking about
in the Sunday Times? Yeah, he talks
because
about
I think
the
he's right. He's saying, why will there be more Ulster players on it? Do more players deserve a shot from Ulster? And how many more could possibly get in? Because he's making the point that Stockdale now has made himself very valuable as a fullback. Tom Stewart has made himself very valuable in as a hooker. And could he possibly displace Gus McCarthy, which is interesting, who's the third choice in Leinster?
He makes a very good argument.
He makes a really good argument for it. And he makes an argument for several more as well. And I do think that we're going to see the two brothers whose father played
for Zach Ward and Bryn Ward.
Zach and Bryn Ward. I think those two are going to come into the picture as well.
Yeah.
So it will be really interesting. And given what they did to Munster recently, it's going to be really interesting to see. If you're a Munster fan and you're interested in there's two featurey pieces today that might interest you. Peter O'Reilly has a piece with Nankerville, big feature piece with Nankerville in the Sunday Times. And then in the Indo, Keane Tracy has a very interesting piece with Antoine Fritsch, who at one point we thought was going to be an Irish player and was going to be, but he's injured at the moment. But if he wasn't, he'd be playing against Munster today, and it's actually really interesting, nice feature on him as well. So there are two pieces that Munster fans I think would be interested to.
Yeah, and Rory Keane talked to Alan Quinlan with a bit of a hark back to the glory days of Munster and back to
they got to get away from that, Orla. They've got to leave that behind.
But they don't. They'll all be still turning out in those jerseys. Those jerseys you can see from the 1999.
Oh, yeah, the old jerseys.
You're going to see a lot of those in the crowd.
Alan Quinlan's looking very young in those photos, like us all. They all look a lot younger. Yeah. And then actually also just, it's worth mentioning because it's a good little bit of a giggle in it as well. And Hugh Farrelly always gives me a giggle in the mail because he talks today. He just has one little opinion piece today on why Ronan O'Gara will never manage Leinster because he is, of course, too Cork.
Yeah, it's not the Munster thing. It's that he's too Cork.
It's Cork. It's not even Munster. Absolutely. Yeah.
Hugh's conclusion is if Ronan O'Gara took over at Leinster, no matter how well he did there, he would never again be able to walk down the South Mile, hang around his old haunts in Bishopstown and Wilton, have a pint in Barry's of Douglas, or go to a Cork Con match in Temple Hill without fear of bitter reproach. And that matters. It's not right or wrong. It is simply the way it is.
It's interesting he didn't do post-match interviews last night.
No.
And Donnacha Ryan did the pre-match one for
Donnacha Ryan did the pre-match. Well. And apparently Ronan's French-speaking assistant came out after the match to have a chat with the lads. And then when they asked if Ronan O'Gara was coming in, they were told they were on the way to the airport.
Already on the plane.
They were getting out of there in a hurry.
I would say they were kittens kicked or boots thrown. I mean, they lost that game. They should never have lost it. I mean, all the stats, you'll see them today in the papers. You know, La Rochelle were on top and everything. And yet, as I said, that's the way sport is interesting sometimes. But it was I thought it was a great game because it was just an open game of rugby.
It was dramatic, yeah.
It wasn't a huge, like, Leinster moved them around. Obviously, they had to. And then, obviously, the La Rochelle forwards got on top. But, like, it wasn't the bish bash bosh game that we thought it was going to be. There was much more open rugby in it than I thought there would be. And it was great.
Yeah.
Good game. That's
what you want. This was a very beatable Leinster team in theory. Yeah. I mean, even though they've won the 3 out of 3 now in the group stage, I think the prevailing conversation after those previous two wins was, okay, they've grinded out this win, but this is not where Leinster want to be.
Yeah, and you'd still say that, Eve. Like, you'd still say they made terrible defensive mistakes last night. They left acres of space at times. And obviously, they were missing a lot of key players in the front row, especially. And their bench was extremely weak by their standards. And they have injuries at the moment. But that's why I think Frawley at fullback is just like, that's such an interesting thing that's going to happen. You know, that they need possibilities. Because Hugo Keenan was so resilient for so long and never got injured.
Yeah.
And he's so important for Ireland as well. But it will be interesting, I think, to see how this next Ireland team is picked and Leinster's form and Ulster's form, how that's going to affect it as well. It will be interesting.
Like that Peter O'Reilly piece we were talking about, like it's something that you think is applicable to Ireland as well, because he talks about how Ulster last season were having such a tough time of it. But like, what was going on was Richie Murphy was giving a lot of young players their time and their space to learn and the ability to make mistakes and, you know, learn how to play in these bigger high pressure games. That now, that what did he say? They finished last season with a 5 consecutive defeats, slumping to a final position of 14th with only Zebre and Dragons beneath them. Given that Ulster now top all attacking metrics in the ORC, it's understandable that a lot of credit has been given to Mark Sexton,
yeah,
the attack coach who arrived in the off-season. But this rather undersells the contribution of Jimmy Duffy, an underrated forwards coach, and of defensive coordinator Willie Falloon, skill coach Dan Soper, and Murphy himself. And they do seem to be building something very good up there.
Well, they all
work
together with the under 20. I think they worked with him before with the under 20s, because I'm looking at Ulster saying, these guys are looking good. What's the change? So I was really interested in reading that all those guys had been involved with them with the Irish under-20s, and that cohesion has been brought to Ulster as well now.
Because when you look back at the November series, as Peter Riley says here, there were only four Ulstermen featured in the initial 36-man squad, equaling the province's lowest representation. You kind of feel like that would be, if you were to see that again, that's kind of doing a disservice to how, as you pointed out, you know, Ulster now topping the attacking metrics in the URC.
Yeah, if you're going on current form, you know, I think it is. This is always the debate, you know, and this is the debate, the Munster-Leinster debate as well. As if you're going to go on form, it would be interesting to see if they get a bounce.
And there's an A squad as well, which is interesting because there's a lot of young guys there that you feel will really benefit from being included in that A squad and getting a bit of, you know, it'll bring them into the environment and they'll learn from that what's expected for the step up to the senior squad. So look, hopefully, because it is nice to see a team playing a nice style of rugby. And that's, you know, as we said, we've seen so many of these games in the URC where it's just deathly dull and horrible to watch.
Some of the rugby this autumn, some of the rugby was dreadful.
And it's like they're bringing out the worst in each other in the URC. And then you see a game like last night where, you know, Leinster, it was a bit of a different approach in that game.
They definitely went at them from the start to be much more expansive,
So the new sort of format, and it's not really new anymore, of the URC, where you're not getting games perhaps of the quality that we'd see last night consistently. Is this almost hampering players' development in a way? You're not playing as many high quality matches perhaps as you're used to, or is it a good training ground for younger players?
Well, this is a backlog then, isn't there? Because there's a lot of people vying for that, like a smaller amount of games where they're going to get the high level experience.
Yeah.
Do you know, if you're looking at teams rotating a lot in their games in the ORC, because there's so many demands on rugby players now. That's the other thing.
And like the physical demand on them.
Physical demands are huge.
That's why there's so many injuries.
Yeah, exactly. Leinster's injury list, you know, the amount of players that you see missing and going out with injuries at any given time, there's a huge level of placed, you know, what's needed on rugby players. So you do wonder if, like, less is more, but we're getting more because we're getting this rugby championship now next summer, aren't we?
Well, that's it. And there's a piece that made me laugh in the Indo as well. It's Gavin Mayers. It's a piece from the Telegraph, and it's sale tuna and the problem with rugby marketing. And it's just this notion again of people trying to, you know, expand the game, but not quite knowing where the market is or how to change the market. But this guy, Marco Mazzotti, he's the owner of the Durban-based Sharks, who are playing well. He's New York based, so he brings all this kind of, you know, American brash business thing to it. And he was slagging off Sale because they're also Sharks, and so he was kind of having this pun about a bit of bants, you know, trying to bring in a bit of rugby bants into it. Exactly, we don't need the bants, but he's saying like, oh, you know, we need to, you know, he's in favour of all of this new stuff of expanding the leagues, that, you know, more like a Champions Cup thing for rugby as well. And he's saying, like, you know, you've got to expand it for the fans. You've got to make it global, and you want to bring more of this marketing stuff to it. But you do look at it and you wonder. And he's like, he mentions Pollock. You know, Pollock is mentioned in the article, and
he's the darling now, isn't he?
Well, you love him or hate him. I like him. I kind of like him because I do like, you know, I do like to see a bit of individuality and a little bit of flair. Yeah. And okay, he's in your face and he's very brash. And this guy is like, the league needs, we need more Pollocks. You know, we need to sell. This is how we want to sell it. So it's interesting to see where rugby is going to go, because I, you know, there's definitely a pressure there from owners to make it a bigger product, make it a more worldwide product. But you have to you have to have those kind of rivalries as well, I think, and that's what we saw last night. You have to have, the competition has to really mean something.
Yeah, and you can
and
LaRochelle
and Leinster absolutely hate each other now.
Everything that's gone before. Like in that piece you were talking about, the Sale piece, he talks about what they're doing on social media. And we added something like 250,000 followers last year, 50,000 just in December. What's the benefit of that?
Yeah.
Wait, tell me why that benefits the club. Like, are you converting them? If you're converting them into bums on seats.
If it's bums on seats, our jerseys sold. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
I'd like to see the conversion statistics on that.
Because you have, I think, the Ulster Rugby TikTok account, they're getting players doing skits. Okay. And they did a Christmas skit a few weeks ago. And it's good to see, you know, a bit of camaraderie in the dressing room. And you know, it shows maybe a cohesion within the team. But at the same time, if you're wanting to grow the game, there's what I think will grow the game is matches like yesterday.
Yeah.
Where people
exactly.
are going to want to go. I mean, we had Susanna Mullen reporting from the Aviva last night, and she was saying it's been a long time since you've seen an atmosphere like
the
that.
The crowd really got behind them. I mean, they were definitely the proud sandwich crowd were not there last night.
At home, did they?
There was 14,000 there and they were roaring last night. The atmosphere was fantastic, you're right. And I don't know whether you've ever been to a match in Ulster, but like I went to a women's international, there, and it's a gorgeous ground and it's made for that kind of, it builds an atmosphere. Ulster fans are very passionate, you know, and I think all of that, but we need good football, we need good games, and last night is the kind of game I think that would really make you watch. Whereas a couple of weeks ago, I actually just stopped watching New York City. I couldn't watch them anymore. I was like, I cannot stand watching another game of kick it up in the air. And these, you know, the new rules have definitely affected the way it's been played.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. I think Leinster had to go for that last night, Orla, because they had to drag them around the field. They had to play an expansive game to try and make space for themselves. And it worked really well.
Yeah,
for a point. And then it didn't, but then it did again, you know. So
that's it. And maybe it was that thing of, you know, they knew they'd be stronger in the finish, because it certainly looked that way, that they looked like they were, you know, they had the physical resilience to last it out to more of a degree.
Definitely.
Like their fitness levels must be really
high. But Botia last night was sensational.
Superb.
I mean,
yeah, given the
Andrew has seen that game, if you get a chance to watch it again. Go and watch that game just for a guy. Talk about levels of fitness for a big guy. He was sensational.
And like player of the match from the losing team, it's not often you see that.
You don't often see it, you're right.
And from the not the home team either.
When it was a local TV coverage. Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess just before we go for a break in a few minutes now, going just back to Harry Byrne and that kind of last minute penalty, the confidence that he showed in saying to Caelan Doris, I want to take this, and then the confidence that his captain showed in him to allow him to do that. Like, this is a player, he's still only 26, but was on loan to Bristol Bears like last season. I don't want to say confidence again, but it's a word that keeps coming to my brain, just how important it was for him to get this and for it to be this huge moment that all the papers are talking about.
Yeah, and he, like, they asked him about it on the coverage afterwards then when they brought him over, and he said that he, you know, he felt... He had missed the previous one and he knew exactly what he'd done wrong. He said there was no wind, you know, I just gave it a bit too much and that's why I missed it. So I knew I was going to get this one. But now he was fresher legs. So you assume there's a good reason for giving it to him. He had taken the previous one. So obviously that decision had been made that he was on the kicks. But yeah, Sam Prendergast certainly didn't look happy. But, you know, fair play to him. He took the decision last season to go and to go to Bristol.
Yeah.
And like as Jonathan Brown talks about it in the Mail, he's talking about how like he had been deemed for a long time to be the other Byrne, with his brother Ross's shadow looming large over a player who had been a star at school level for St. Michael's College. He was the starting number 10 for the Ireland under 20s. There was always huge hype around Harry Byrne. Like, we've heard it for years, you know. Ross Byrne came out and played for Leinster, and everybody was always, you hear this so often, but like, wait till you see the younger brother. He's going to be even better again.
It's taken
a little bit of time. It took time for him to break through. And, you know, there was always that thing of backlog at Leinster, right, in terms of the number 10s. And there was a perception that, well, you're better off being the third choice out half at Leinster than you are going elsewhere. But he took the decision to go to Bristol, and it was a chance call from the Bears to help out his cover because AJ McGinty was injured. He only played in 11 matches, but he said it had a profound effect. He talked about Pat Lam and the impact he had on him as a player and how he developed and grew from that
time. And I think too, Pat Lam, having come from Connacht, would have had that understanding of Irish rugby to deal with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Would have understood the pressure that he's on, the family thing, you know, being under a microscope in Ireland and getting him over to Bristol as well. I think that there's an element there. Pat Lam is very popular. Was very popular in as a player's man in Connacht, and I think maybe that has helped. Marie Kinsley did a really good piece this week as well, worth catching up on the 42, if anybody has access to that as well, on the intrigue around the Irish number 10 position as well, because Carberry now, the possibility that Carberry's going to come back to Leinster. There's a fascinating conversation, and he did a really good trawl through all the potential people who could come back into line, and actually Harry Byrne had right in the middle of it as well.
And it'd be some late career renaissance now for Joey Carberry to come back and, you know, force his way into that conversation.
Imagine.
As well. But then he's only 30, I think, isn't he?
Yeah,
like, he's not.
When you think about it in those terms, he's still a very young man.
Absolutely, yeah. So for him to come back and go back to Leinster, and, you know, there is a sort of a perception he never really wanted to leave. Like, it was kind of, he felt he had to for the sake of his career. To go.
Absolutely. And then Frawley, you know, potentially going to Connacht because he wants, that's the position he wants
to
play.
And he's been told he's there as an out half.
Yes, that's what they'll take him as an out half. And you have that. And then you have Carty as well. Like, you know, it got very polarised into just two people in the last season, but maybe there's more people to come. And again, isn't that what's going to be interesting to watch this season?
Yeah, I liked in the Mail on Sunday, Jonathan Brown just comparing Harry Byrne to Rocky.
It's a good
redemption story. I think we can probably take a break at the moment, but we've got lots more of the day's sport writing after this. Welcome back to the Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball's Nollaig na Mban special, where I'm joined by sports writer Cliona Foley and sports editor of the Irish Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, Orla McElroy. Now, we were chatting before the show, Cliona, about some pretty exciting, well, potentially, WSL news.
Yeah, it's been doing the rounds for a while, and fair dues to the Echo in Cork were the first ones to break the story, the potential that Denise O'Sullivan is potentially going to sign for Liverpool in the WSL. This would be a massive story, I think, for Irish fans as well, because just the potential even to go over and watch her play in England would be fantastic. She's been in America for so long. She's been in America, I think, 8 years. She was briefly home. She was on loan in Brighton in 2020 for a very short spell. But otherwise, we haven't seen her playing in a what we'd call a local league, and we just don't have access to watch her playing for Carolina. We don't see her playing in America, and also for the Irish team where they are and where the potential is for qualification. She has to fly home for all these camps,
and I always
think it takes a bit out of her. Sometimes she just runs herself into the ground, and I think, Jesus, after making that trip, that's a lot to put on her. So if she was back, it would be brilliant. I just noticed with interest, this story broke just before Christmas that she might come to Liverpool. Mark Gallagher in the Mail on Sunday says, actually, you know, it looked like she was going to come, but it hasn't happened. And he says the story has kind of gone quiet in England. And I trawled some of the sites this morning, just the women's football sites, just to see if there's any heat on it. And it doesn't appear to be anything new breaking on it. But Paul Rowan on the front of the Sunday Times, he says in his last paragraph in his piece on the front of Sunday Times, which is actually about Gavin Bazuma, he says she is completing a move from North Carolina Courage to Liverpool. You see, Liverpool are struggling desperately.
They haven't
won a game this season, right? And the Women's Super League is back. And thank you to the Mail on Sunday and the editor beside us today, because at least she carried a match report from Arsenal and Man United yesterday, which I can't find in any other papers. So that's good to see, because there should be way more coverage, really, of the Women's Super League in the papers today. But they're just back from the break. Liverpool are struggling badly, and they have a really good Japanese player. I'm trying to think of her name. She's in midfield, Nagano. But she badly needs support with her. And they have a few people injured as well. They've got hit with a few ACLs. So to get us a player like O'Sullivan, who is not only a brilliant midfielder, but actually really good defensively as well, and works her butt off every time she plays on the field. It would be a great get for Liverpool,
I think. She's a big Man United fan, though. Like, she doesn't come to Liverpool.
Yeah, but look, Katie McCabe wasn't an Arsenal. She wasn't originally Arsenal, was she? Am I right in thinking that?
I'm not sure.
I could be wrong. I thought her club affiliations were different originally. But look, I don't think it would matter. Like, if she's coming from America, I think they'd be prepared to pay good money for her.
She would be well worth it.
And it would be a real boost to Irish women's football. football fans and also to Ireland fans as well.
Like Mark makes that point that you made about, you know, this long haul trip every time she's coming over for a camp or whatever. And there's a couple of, you know, there is a couple of players over in the US, but it's so much easier for Katie and for all the players that are based in England playing in the WSL and WSL too, because there's a lot of players there. But also, as you say, to go over, like, the amount of people that are going over to Arsenal games from from here, you know, it's incredibly good value. Like the tickets are really great value. You get to go to the Emirates, and their Mark highlights their average attendance.
Oh, there's a huge. It's 40,
they're the best
40
supported grand, women's club in Europe. Their average league attendance is 36,214, nearly four times as big as the second place club Bayern Munich, whose average is 9,365. Like, they're doing so much right. They've given René Slager's an extended contract
until 2029.
Very long term, which is unusual in the women's game as well.
You know, coach, you're still very young as well.
And it's interesting, actually, you're talking about Irish fans going over to see Katie McCabe. I was in the Aviva for the last Republic game, I was there with my niece and her kiddies and her husband, and beside them were three young women who had come, Arsenal fans.
Really?
They cried. They cried when Katie McCabe, when she scored that brilliant goal from the free kick, they cried at one point in the game, and my niece was looking at them going, they're insane. But they were insane, Katie McCabe, and they come to Ireland to watch her play for the Republic of Ireland. That's how big Katie McCabe is in England, and that's how big Arsenal are in England, you know. And I just think Denise, and also it's the style of football she plays. Do you know what I mean? Like, we have Ireland players come, and we have some really good Irish players who come back from the American League as well to play for Ireland. But I don't think anybody covers every blade of grass the way Denise O'Sullivan does. And she can't stop herself. Do you know what I mean? If she comes back and she's told, take it easy this game, you know, we don't need you running every... She'll still do it. It's not her... She can't stop herself. So it is an exhausting thing for her. I was happy to see she was in Belize over Christmas, having a very lovely holiday with her partner. So hopefully she's well rested. But it is interesting. And one of her Instas before Christmas as well, she did say something like, nothing beats being home. You know, she's quintessentially Cork and a home bird. Yeah. It'd be great if it happens. Anyway, I think definitely on our special, Nollaig na mBan special, it's worth highlighting that story, because I think it's one that's people should be keeping an eye on.
Yeah, and just in general, he does take a look at, like, the, you know, sort of a state of the nation. We'd done one yesterday in the Saturday paper on the men's squad. So it's kind of, you know, what's going on with the Irish players over there at the moment.
No, it's a good piece.
Those qualifiers are coming up soon.
Yeah, next month. And I think with all the drama around the men's team, and, you know, rightfully so, with the playoffs now coming in March, I think the women's team and their qualifiers for getting has sort of been pushed to the side slightly, or if maybe we're not talking about it yet, we will be, obviously.
Yeah.
And if we could get, you know, Denise O'Sullivan, if she's playing closer to home when we need her most, I think it would be huge.
I think we can only benefit from it. Exactly. Yeah, it's a good piece, because he has the two tables as well. He has a summary of the two Super League tables, 1 and 2, in that piece by Mark as well today.
I mean, you've Arsenal, who are Champions League winners now. Yeah. Katie McCabe is a Champions League winner.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I think René Slager's agreed when she said it really was 2 points dropped with that game against Manchester United.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A bit of a dire nil-nil. And with,
it was bad nil-nil.
Nil-nil. Yeah. There are certain bad nil-nils that you see every now and then, especially with United down to 10 men for a portion of that second half. So,
and it was put to her afterwards that, like, their problem is kind of, it's the accuracy rather than, like, their playmaking is good and they're, you know, they're playing well, but they're just not capable of finishing it off.
I think,
and she said that we just, you know, we need to put the ball in the net.
Need to score. And I think it's a problem for the Irish women's team as well, is that ability to just, we don't have an out and out striker. We don't have a killer striker.
That's why there was so much elation with that game the last day, because you were looking at it going, God, this is, you know, this is such a treat to see so many goals, you know?
Yeah, it was brilliant.
It was brilliant. But it is something that definitely both of the Irish teams really have had a little bit of a struggle with. I know Troy Parrott's come along and done wonders.
We need to find a female Troy Parrott.
We need to find, we need one of those. Or Leanne Kiernan, who's at Liverpool.
Yeah, who's at Liverpool. And
she's a great goal scorer.
And again,
but we just
if
need
Denise
to get her
came
more.
Back even to Liverpool for Leanne, who's a natural goal scorer, that would be such benefit for her as well, I think.
Sure.
Definitely. I'd like to move on to a piece by Michael Foley in the Sunday Times about Katie Taylor.
Yeah.
We were speaking about this outside, a lovely piece.
Yeah, really nice piece. I was really interested in this. It's very unusual what Katie Taylor is doing at the moment. And so the question being asked is this the end? Is she going to continue? Is she calling time? Because she's never done as much public speaking and as many interviews and as many. But I was following. She did an audience with down in Killarney this year, this week.
It was Friday night.
Friday night. Yeah. And it got massive, like, it got a huge ticket sales. And I remember thinking, like, I've interviewed her over the years. I saw her box in the stadium the first time women were allowed to box in the stadium. Guards were allowed in there. I've followed her career. I've been at the Olympics. I've been followed everything. But, like, she's not an easy interview. And my thing was, like, how is Katie going to hold an audience there for, you know, that amount of time, paying good money? And it's a good piece by Michael Foley because he goes at it from that premise and he wants just to brings us behind the curtain a bit to see what happened at this thing. And she, you know, there is no hyperbole about Katie. There never will be. She'll never go. She'll never do the big Muhammad Ali stuff. But what I was struck at, first of all, was watching the Insta stuff during the week. I've never seen her smile as much. I've never seen her look as happy. I've never seen her look as relaxed. You know, and as I said, I've watched her play soccer for when she was 15. I watched her play international soccer before she became a Finns boxer. She is in her moment. And the question is now, is this all because she's not going to box anymore? Or what does it mean? And actually, somebody asked the question. Obviously, they took questions from the floor and she was asked, which is a question that journalists don't ask often. And Katie, if you ever asked her anything about her private life, could get very prickly. But she was asked if she wanted to have kids. And
she handled it very deftly.
She handled it very deftly. A great answer. She said, I think I'd be a very intense parent to a kid. Can you imagine little 5-year-old Katie Jr. on a football field? I'm saying, come on now, work through the pain barrier. But thankfully, my husband, Sean, is the most laid back, chill guy in the world. It's actually quite funny. I'm so intense and he's so laid back. Opposites attract, I guess. And there's just plenty of nice little insights into her. She was asked, did she want another fight? And she didn't rule
it
out.
That's the other big question.
And she doesn't rule it out. And she mentions Crow Park yet again, but she also mentions Vegas, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So, like, she hasn't fully closed the door there, even though she hasn't said yes or no. She hasn't fully closed the door. But what really interests me is that she's working with a young fighter called Tia May Aiton, a young fighter emerging from Brian Peters Stables, who's her Irish manager. And she describes her as the best female boxer I've ever seen. So there's a name to watch out for, Tia May Aiton, A-Y-T-O-N. It's a lovely piece. And I just think it's a very touching piece.
It is. And it's but the thing you touch on about, like, the next fight, that's what we all want to know.
Yeah.
Because, like,
yeah.
Maybe the ship has sailed on the Croke Park date, which is such a pity.
That's down to her own management, I believe, not Croke Park.
You know, and if she never gets to fight there, it will be an awful pity because I don't, like, she's extraordinarily popular with everybody in this country.
She has such appeal.
You know, she is extraordinary appeal.
Respect,
people love her and rightly so for everything that she's done. She's such an understated trailblazer and with, you know, no hubris in comparison to so many people in the fight game. So it'll be an awful pity if she doesn't get that and that, you know, the Three Arena was her only fight here. I would love to see her have another fight, only if it's the right fight. Like, there's been talk about her fighting a UFC fighter.
Oh, no,
and this
please.
Kind of nonsense.
No,
like,
more
don't
that
go
craziness.
There.
No,
just
no,
don't
no,
go
no.
There.
No, and that's exactly what she says.
Yeah.
They look at the quote
because
down there.
Because there's very few people.
Yeah.
Who's she going to fight?
Yeah.
You know, like, we've done Serrano.
Yeah.
Cameron, Katie herself kind of points out that Cameron, you know, hasn't really earned another shot at Katie.
But she actually uses that phrase, which is great. I like
to
see
true,
that.
And it's true, because, you know, who is there for... There's no more worlds left to conquer for Katie, really.
Yeah. So the quote is, I don't think I need another fight, but I do want another fight. It needs to be a fight that excites me.
Yeah.
So that's our line on it.
It's when you've reached the top, where do you go from then? It's such a difficult question for her. Yeah. She is kind of grappling with it, not in a very somber way or anything, but it's on her mind kind of.
And, you know, it must be informed by her life and where she is in her life now. Like, she talked about it on the late that time.
Yeah.
She talked about how she was, it was a lovely phrase, I'm in a different season of my life now.
Yeah.
And how, you know, she has married. She has now 5 stepchildren, isn't it?
Had she? That meant had, wow, yeah, I didn't know that.
And he had a grown family. His first wife had died. And there's a lot going on in her life now. So you wonder, will that kind of inform what's going on in terms of fighting and her possible return to the ring? But look, whatever she's done, there'll never be another one like her. Athlete.
It's a lovely
Never
piece.
Mind
it's a well
woman.
Worth piece, yeah. And he says how affected she was by just the size of the crowd that were there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. She was welling up by the time she arrived.
Yeah, she's actually the lead who sponsored the ladies football league, Gaelic football league. They always start the season with a press conference with some research and some big figures.
Oh, yeah.
And Taylor is speaking at that actually in 2 weeks' time, again, Tuesday week, which again is a very unusual thing. I think what a lineup. Hannah Terrell and Katie Taylor, I think, are two of the speakers. That'll be really interesting. But she's doing this kind of stuff that she wouldn't ever have done if she was in that full time training. So she's definitely out of that at the moment.
Yeah.
But whether she'll go back into it, whether she wants to go back into it, I don't know. There's a great line that you have this little girl. Lives in a council estate, a very poor area, and she has this dream she has no right to achieve.
Yeah. And it's so, it's she willed women's boxing into the Olympics.
It's
extraordinary when you look back,
I always remember
your mention of Hannah Tyrrell remind me of one of the, it was such a good thing I read today.
There's another good piece that links with this.
About St. Bridges, and he talked about when he was with Mick Bohan with the Dublin ladies, and he said he had to drive to Dublin twice weekly, leaving home at 3:30, not getting back until 1:30 the next morning, but the experience was invaluable. And he said there was never an excuse not to be at training. Hannah Tyrrell will be in the gym in DCU with a pram at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, that's the one.
And it just shows you the dedication, like Hannah Tyrrell, another extraordinary athlete. Like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, look, I think it's a very interesting period. Loads of people say this thing. Oh, I wish she wouldn't box anymore. I don't want to see her get hit. I feel she has earned the right to do whatever she wants to do with her life. She's extraordinary.
Totally.
But I just do think I've never seen her look happier.
Yeah, true. And I thought, with the last Serrano fight or the one before, I thought I'm never going to second guess Katie again. Katie knows best. And, if she feels she's done, she's, as you say, exactly right. And she has the right to decide when she is done.
That Orla mentioned there is a really good piece in the Sunday Indo, and it's with Evan Talty, and he's a name that'll be familiar to a lot of people who are involved in coaching in Ireland, Gaelic Games coaching. He's a coach's coach, if you like. He's big into coaching. It's a really good piece. He is involved today with St. Bridget's in the All Ireland Club Final. Anthony Cunningham got him on board because he's worked with a lot of other teams, and one of the things that struck us both about the piece was that he worked with the Clare ladies, the Galway ladies football, and then he ended up working with the Dublin ladies football team as well, and he uses examples of a lot of the women's teams to reference what he has learned most about the importance of coaching. But he's also a guy who really got into coaching quite young, and also got into coaching because he had somebody in his club who affected him greatly. And it was a guy called Murray in his home club in Clare. He also runs the family run a really interesting business, Irish Seaweeds, and he's trying to do all that and involved with coaching. But I think it's well worth piece. If you're interested in GA club and you're interested in coaching in the GA, it's a really good piece. And I love that line that he used about the Hannah Tyrrell one, because he said, you learn that culture is not something you write up on a wall.
That was brilliant.
You know, and this line, the old All Blacks line that we all get, it's not sweeping out the dressing rooms. That's not culture. Culture is doing what you say you're going to do and doing it every day and doing it consistently. And he said, if you look at what Mick Bohan would have preached in Dublin, the value of strong Dublin independent women, he said he saw all of that when he worked in the Dublin women's backroom team, but it's something that he brings into coaching with him. But it's interesting, he was influenced by this amazing man in his own club, a guy called Patrick Murray, who went around the local primary schools coaching in Clare. And he was influenced by him. And now, because, you see a lot online, and there's a lot of very good stuff online, I find, with, people who are interested in coaching GA in club level, and coaching it right, and not the win at all cost thing. I think, is that in this as well, or did I come across it somewhere else? Came across that piece somewhere else this week where someone was saying, when I was younger, I thought winning, it was yeah, I model myself on Roy Keane and people like that. I thought win at all costs. But now that I'm older, that's not how I approach things. And I think maybe with age, you do, you, your mind does change about the way you coach, you know, and the way you play sport and the way you coach. But he has that perspective in it. And it's really interesting in what we're talking about today about women's sport, that a lot of what he learned, is interestingly, he's learned from women's Gaelic.
Yeah. And the, just on the previous pages, one you pointed me to, which was, as seen as this is a sports newspaper slot, we'll indulge ourselves for a second.
Oh, yeah.
About Dennis Hurley.
Oh, Dennis Hurley. Yeah.
You showed no, go this on, to yeah, me. He's yeah. a sports reporter with the Echo. And at the Kilbritton game yesterday, he was... It was his brother James started fullback, and his brother-in-law was the manager, and he was up in the press box writing his match report.
Away writing the match report because everyone's looked unlucky. At the Kilbritton game yesterday and saw the walls, the two brothers, the walls. But here you have an example, and we know what it's like as a sports reporter. You have to be independent sometimes. Your brother's playing fullback, your brother-in-law is managing the team, and you have to go up and write the match report on a game that is as thrilling as that. But he was saying,
and like, meaningful.
We know what it's like. Sometimes we say, would you not prefer to be down there? And he said, You can't, as a sports reporter, you can't enjoy sport the same way because you have to be objective. You have to have a neutral stance. And he also says, I can stay calmer watching it from above. And also he said, I'm afraid I'd jinx it if I went as a fan and not as as I am doing my job. Dennis is a very good sports writer. And also the match reports yesterday do point out that, you know, it was quite controversial, the sending off of Andy Kilcullen for Eastkey, and Eastkey would have their issues yesterday with that decision because it was a harsh decision. Definitely.
Questionable, wasn't it?
And you can, I know for a fact that Dennis Hurley, and the kind of reporter he is, he would have made that point in his match report as well, because he's a very good journalist. But it is that's the joy of being a sports reporter sometimes, is that you just have to do the job even when that craziness is happening around you.
Yeah,
so there's more, of course, Gaelic Games action on today, which we'll have lots on the show throughout the evening. Is there any other last kind of little bits and bobs you wanted to mention?
There's a couple of pieces. Don McLean in the Sunday Times is just interesting on, obviously he's a great horse racing writer, but he's interesting on the fact that we may be seeing a little bit of return from English trainers in the jump game.
Yeah.
Because he points out that Dan Skelton is going so well at the moment, and he's not the only one. Ollie Murphy is going well. Is it Ben? I'm trying to think of his name, the third guy. But he's just pointing out that, you know, the way Cheltenham has nearly become a procession for the Irish. And it's not, I think it loses a bit of its value when it's been so dominated by Irish
you
horses.
You need the,
it's this thing of, you need jeopardy, you need competition, you need proper real life rivalries. So if English trainers are now getting a bit more success, and he points out that they are this season already, then it may make for a more interesting national hunt season.
Yeah, and maybe there's definitely a feeling in England that they have got a better, you know, they're definitely going to put it up to the Irish horses. They don't feel Cheltenham will be anything like what it's been in the last few years. But you can see as well, like, Gordon Elliott was very successful over Christmas.
Great Fair House.
He's been in,
Leopardstown.
He's been in incredible form. And Ben Pauling was the one you were talking about.
Ben Pauling, the jukebox man winning the King George. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So there's been some, a lot of sharing around in comparison to previous years, where you would have seen a lot of Willie Mullins, though he always comes later in the season.
Yeah,
you will always see that. He'll finish off the season, yeah.
And the other thing I like, something that I really liked, is in the Sunday Times, you know, they do this thing in the back page, you know, this eat, drunk, drink, love. You know, it's one of these Q&As, this quick fire, quick round ones. But champion jump jockey, Sean Bone, I don't know whether any of you saw this, but, like, you know, these classic questions, what do you want to eat? Who do you want, you know, your dream dinner party? I love this guy's attitude. His dream party, I'm not sitting down with random famous strangers. It would be too awkward. So it's a family occasion. So he goes through them all. His mother, Karen, his father, who's a trainer as well, who moans too much. His brother, who is a trainer as well and can really put away the food. His other brother, James, and his wife, because she likes a nice restaurant. And then it's loads of other stuff. This guy's never drunk, so he doesn't have a worst hangover. Now, I'm not a film person. They go on too long and I'm impatient. I go to the cinema and I fall asleep. I'd say we can all identify with that.
This
is a sports guy I can identify with. And also the one I really like is his favourite album. I don't listen to albums because there are always a few dud tracks on each one. So it's a very modern
skiing.
He's skiing.
This is crazy.
And,
like,
well, actually, that's really surprising because Jockey's usually won't go skiing in case they get injured. Yeah. That is his thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I kind of like that because it was a very different kind of one that you get in those usual classic answers that you get to all those.
Nice to get a glimpse.
Exactly. Brilliant. All right, I think that's all we have time for today. Orla and Cliona, thank you so much for joining me.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.